Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Charles Hugh Smith. He's author, leading global finance blogger, and America's philosopher, we call him. He's the author of several books on our economy and society, including A Radically Beneficial World, Automation, Technology, and Creating Jobs for All, Resistance, Revolution, Liberation, A Model for Positive Change, The Nearly Free University in the Emerging Economy, Pathfinding Our Destiny, Preventing the Final Fall of Our Democratic Republic, and Will You Be Richer or Poorer? His blog of twominds.com is one of CNBC's top alternative finance sites. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. I'm looking forward to our topic today.
Yes, which is very interesting. We're going to look at another comparison. In the past, we did one comparing what's happening today to the Great Fire of Rome, 64 AD. And today, we're going to look at a comparison that you've written about is 2021 an echo of 1641? So 2021 to 1641. You know, what similarities are there to that time frame, and what does it mean about what's going on today? What could happen? Your initial thoughts?
Yeah, thank you, Richard. Well, this topic did seem appropriate to me. Because as we know, the sort of saying is that history rhymes, and history rhymes because we're still using the same wetware. You know, we're still using our genetic coding 1.0, right?
Yeah.
So naturally, our responses to scarcities and surpluses is going to be similar, you know, no matter what the time frame. So I've read this book, a recent history book called Global Crisis, War, Climate Change, and Catastrophe in the 17th Century. And it's actually a global survey of all the disruptions, wars, revolutions, and traumas in the 1600s that resulted from it being the Little Ice Age. In other words, there was a long-term cooling, and so the climate changed, and it ruined the crop and grain production in the Northern Hemisphere. And so that triggered scarcities in food, and that generated a knock-on effect of many social and political conflicts, which played out on global stages. And so it occurred to me that regardless of what you think about climate change, I think that there's other scarcities which are coming up, which kind of overlap. There's a potential for food scarcity in our era. There's a potential for energy scarcity, if not in supply, in affordability. In other words, a scarcity of energy that people can afford on their current wages. I think we could argue that there's a scarcity of places for capital to go that are productive. There's a scarcity of good paying jobs. And so all these scarcities, I think, are visible in our sort of tottering financial system and a lot of the political conflicts we're observing.
Yeah, very interesting. So it seems like there's reinforcing, overlapping type of events that are happening. And as you mentioned, very similar to this time as well. Even climate change, there's observations on the sunspots and how that correlates to mini ice ages happening. But then there's also supply chain disruptions as a result of COVID and the pandemic. And also the overall situation with travel and shipping, the economy has been locked down. So all of that could result in similar type of shortages, not only in food, but in other aspects. And actually today we're doing this on today on January 26th. If you look at commodity food prices, we're going just totally vertical today. Soybeans, corn, wheat. So this has been not only today, but for the past, it's been going up for the past several weeks. Looks like it continues to go. Your thoughts?
Yeah, exactly. And just as another sort of context for supply and scarcity, we have to remember that in the, like, say, 40s and 50s, there was about 2.3 billion humans, right? And, 50 or 60 short years later, there's 7.8 billion humans. So, you know, the human population has exploded, and we've kind of gotten away with that kind of tremendous increase in resources consumption because of the Green Revolution, use of oil-based fertilizers, modifying grains to be more productive and so on, and bringing in marginal land. But all of those, at least in some of those aspects of supply, are vulnerable, as you say. Like marginal land becomes unaffected. You know, it's no longer productive when the climate cools or increases. And then we have dependencies. Most of the world is dependent on a few grain exporting nations. And if they encounter, you know, shortages, then there's going to be a global shortage very quickly. So there's a lot of knock-on effects because of globalization. And as you say, globalization, and we've discussed this in the past, is weakening, right? I mean, I think we've sort of reached peak globalization. And so there's those scarcities. And then if we look at what's in oversupply, what was oversupplied in the 1600s was monarchies. You know, that they had a lot of nation states and empires were ruled by one individual, and there was not yet a political development of representation of other classes and other interests in society, and so that sole individual could make terrible decisions, like going to war when the conflict could have been resolved diplomatically, right? And so in our era, historian Peter Turchin has listed three things that are in oversupply that are creating disorder, you know, at a structural level in the global economy. One is an oversupply of what he calls parasitic elites. And of course, you can describe that however you want, but that generally includes rentier class people who are not really productive, but are drawing resources out of the economy, and they often don't pay their share of taxes. You know, they have subsidies or giveaways because of their political power, that kind of thing. And then I think we have an oversupply of state and private debt, you know, the debt crisis we've discussed. And we have a global oversupply of ordinary labor. In other words, it's very hard throughout the world to make enough money to have a secure middle class lifestyle. And so there's all these sources of oversupply are just as distorting as scarcities.
And from this graphic, can you explain how this relates to the 1641 timeframe?
Right. And so if we think about, the 1640s and the human response to the scarcities, of course, it's a political response, first and foremost, right? I mean, because human society is a social structure, and so then politics and favoritism are always part of that structure. So what the monarchies and the elites tried to do, of course, was to protect their access to resources and minimize the taxes they paid, right? And then that pushed the burden of scarcities and higher taxes onto the commoners. And then the commoners were getting to the point where they couldn't pay the taxes and have enough to eat. So then they would rebel, and there'd be these uprisings. I mean, dozens upon dozens or even hundreds of uprisings from China all the way through into Europe. And so these scarcities exacerbate class differences and class conflicts. And there's no easy way to sort that out, especially if you get polarization where, you know, each class is actually hardens its position and the middle ground disappears. And so then you have the only option appears to be open warfare or conflict. And so when you have an oversupply of parasitic elites, then you know that they are actually an unproductive burden on your economy. And so for them to keep their share intact as scarcities and disruptions occur, then it means there's considerably less for the commoners and the productive class. So you're gonna create conflict if you're gonna protect your parasitic elites from any scarcity or higher taxes. And then, of course, state and private debt. The same thing happened in the 1640s, if you can believe it, that monarchies went out and borrowed heavily from, you know, Dutch bankers and other bankers. And then they had to raise taxes, sometimes tripling the tax load on commoners in order to pay the interest and principal on these huge debts they'd acquired. To kind of keep the status quo glued together and finance their wars. And so those issues, I think, are really visible today.
And in your blog post on this for 1641, you mentioned 14 points which describe how elites and commoners try to secure resources and political power and how these conflicts drain the system of resilience. Can you go through each one of those 14 briefly? That would be interesting. Lots of parallels to what's happening today.
Right. I think so. And the other interesting parallel is that this disrupts the economies and societies within countries, but it also creates geopolitical imbalances of power. So, it seems this is sort of my summary. I want to make sure it's not the author's. I've sort of summarized what I learned from his book is that, you know, the owners of capital, you know, the elites, they, of course, try to use their influence to make the state protect their resources and capital. Right. So and as I said, because the pie is shrinking, then that means there's less for everybody else. And so those disenfranchised masses, they will seek redress from the state by whatever means they have. They might protest at parliament or the legislature. If there is a legislature, they might seek, you know, some kind of political voice. And if that's denied to them, then you get like open rebellion and uprisings. And meanwhile, the state's resources are diminished. Not just by the underlying scarcity, but conflicts cause a decline in trade and commerce. And so there's trade just completely vanished for decades in the 1600s because of conflict, wars, civil conflict, and wars between the nation states. So of course, commerce is a primary source of tax revenues for the state. So while everybody's demanding the state do more, the state's resources are diminishing. So the fifth point is the overlapping crises reveal and exploit weaknesses in the structures, in the social, economic, and political structures. So, for example, this whole thing of having too much power concentrated in a small group of people, that seemed to work fine when there's plenty to go around. But once there's conflict, then the smaller the group of people with the greatest amount of power, any flawed decision on their part can unleash all kinds of second order effects. In other words, bad decisions have really bad consequences when you're in this sort of fragile, vulnerable state of scarcity. Mm-hmm. And then as the state falters or divides into warring factions, then the most powerful elites start taking over state functions, right? And I think you could say that big tech is doing that today, yeah. Right? In other words, it's like social media is now is now more powerful in many day-to-day ways than the government. And so every society has a lot of different loyalties, right, and forms of identity, right? There's regional and ethnic and religious. And unfortunately, when there's scarcities and people are trying to, you know, access whatever they can or keep their resource, those start fragmenting. And so these scarcities in the 1600s triggered religious wars where people went back to their fundamental identity, which was religion or ethnic or national. And so this exacerbated warfare and conflict between nation states. And when there's this fevered competition for loyalty, then the leaders of each faction their natural instinct is to make it even more us and them. In other words, get rid of any middle ground. You're either with us or you're against us, right? And so because they want to confirm or reinforce the loyalty of their members of the faction. So the conflicts that are generated by this dynamic are devastating, right? And into the competing factions. And so when one side wins a political or military conflict, well, their first instinct is to take revenge on the losers. And I have to say, I think that you could argue that the Democrats are pursuing a bit of revenge on the losers of the last election here in the U.S., right? That you want to take back what you lost and then exact a measure of revenge. And of course, that just fuels the antipathy and source of conflict. It eliminates whatever middle ground was left. And so what we see in the 1600s is only when the people and treasure of the nations has been exhausted in conflict, only then do people kind of give up the desire to win and they're willing to compromise. And the irony of this whole thing is that compromise and diplomacy could have solved all those problems at the beginning. But humans, just their initial response to scarcity is to form these factions and harden their positions ideologically and so on, and pursue a resolution from conflict rather than compromise and diplomacy. So that's, I think, a very valid fear here in the 2020s, both within nation states, you know, so-called civil conflicts, and also between geopolitical power centers.
Given these 14 elements, can you do a comparison to what could happen or how we could evolve in the current timeframe, current era?
Yeah, well, I think it's a great question, Richard. And I will say that in this overview, this book, Global Crisis, that he pinpoints that Japan, which was ruled by a very authoritarian political structure, the shogun and so on, they had a much more positive response. Japan suffered far less than other nations, and the reasons were twofold. One, the Tokugawa shogunate shared the resources. It imposed restrictions on its elites that they couldn't overconsume, they couldn't abuse the commoners, or else their fiefdom would be basically expropriated. It would be taken from them. And so it put limits on elite consumption and elite power, and then it shared the grain. When there were failed harvests, then it opened public granaries to distribute rice so the commoners wouldn't starve. And then it also reduced taxes and put whatever funds that were spent into like infrastructure for better roadways and canals and that kind of thing. So those were positive policy responses to disastrous harvests and scarcities, right? And then secondly, the Tokugawa shogunate avoided foreign entanglements. They refused to get involved in foreign wars, although there were pressures and invitations for them to do so, because the burdens of war exacerbate, you know, your scarcities. And so I think that's an interesting example, because where these countries spiral down into these conflicts, like the 30 Years' War in Germany or the Civil War in England, or the collapse of the Ming Empire in China in 1644, then this creates like decades of scarcities, conflicts, rebellions, all of which only further reduce economic output and create even more scarcities, right? So I think going forward, if we can look at the Tokugawa, even though they were an authoritarian regime, they did do a positive policy response by sharing what essentials were available, reducing the burdens of their elites, and then investing in infrastructure to further commerce and increase production. So I think that's a possible lesson for all of us, whether we're in developing world or developed world countries.
Do you think some of those elements could happen over the next few years? And if so, within what time frame and to what extent?
Yeah, well, you know, Richard, we've talked in the past about how globally the rural economies have been strip mined and in favor of the cities, right? I mean, the population has gone urban, and the rural communities and rural economies where the food is grown have often died on the vine, you know, as for a lot of reasons. And so I think like some countries like China, for example, have attempted to reverse this by attempting to, you know, invest more in the rural West and so on. And I think that could be a global response, you know, that every country that grows food and could start investing more in their rural productive economy. Instead of, you know, basically giving all the resources to the big city and urban concentrations.
Yeah, and it seems like that's happening now with the migration of people in cities going to the suburbs or going to the countryside, exurbs, or way out into the countryside. So that would definitely help out local rural communities.
Yeah, and I think I think we're seeing a heightened awareness of the problems created by wealth and income inequality. Right, that by many measures, wealth and income inequality in the U.S. is reaching extremes of like the Gilded Age or the 1929. And so clearly, you know, any kind of political movement that would reduce the gains of the billionaire class or the super financial elites that would be beneficial, you know, is to take some of their capital or some of their income and devote it to more public good or shared social good. I will mention briefly, there was a RAND study that came out a few months ago that looked at the distribution of capital and income, you know, in the United States in the mid-70s to the present. And in that 45-year time frame, something like $50 trillion was siphoned off from the working and middle class into the hands of the financial elite. And so obviously you need to reverse that trend if there's going to be scarcities and employment is more insecure and there's political polarization, you know, like you've got to kind of get back to the middle. The pendulum is going to have to swing back and create some middle ground, you know, for the social good to take place.
Great. And how can our, listeners learn more about your work? It's been great insight on this analogy, Charles.
Yeah, thank you so much. Please visit me at uptwominds.com. There's all my archives are free, and samples of my books are also free if you want to check those out.
Great. Thank you so much, Charles.
Thank you, Richard.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only. and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.